This is Terrence McNally. This week I'm going to share with you one of my favorite previously recorded interviews with author and New Yorker writer George Packer about his 2013 National Book Award winning bestseller, The Unwinding. It tells the story of the United States over the past three decades by focusing on the lives of an Ohio factory worker, a Washington political operative, North Carolinian small businessman, and an internet billionaire, and it originally aired in June 2013.
Late evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould described humans as the primate who tells stories. Civilizations have existed for millennia without the wheel, but as far as we know, no society exists without stories. Now, I believe it is useful to talk about the 1% and the 99%. Useful to quote how much of the nation's income and wealth have shifted from the bottom and middle to the top since the 70s, or even worse, since the crash of 2008. Useful to know how many hundred lobbyists exist for every one senator or congressperson. Useful to cite how many millions of dollars spent in the 2012 campaign came from undisclosed donors. How much a CEO makes relative to the average worker, how little corporations pay in taxes, how no one knows what a colonoscopy actually costs. All well and good, but even more, I want to know the stories. And George Packer has written a remarkable book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. In it, he argues that seismic economic shifts during a single generation have created a country of winners and losers, leaving the social contract in pieces and setting citizens adrift to find new paths forward. Packer sees America as a superpower in danger of coming apart at the seams. Its elites no longer elite. Its institutions no longer relevant. We've covered a lot of this ground before on Free Forum, but the power of The Unwinding is in how Packer tells his truth. He begins, and I'm going to quote from the prologue, "No one can say when the unwinding began, when the coil that held Americans together in its secure and sometimes stifling grip first gave way. Like any great change, the unwinding began at countless times, in countless ways, and at some moment the country, always the same country, crossed a line of history and became irretrievably different. If you were born around 1960 or afterward, you've spent your adult life in the vertigo of that unwinding." Now, he follows the prologue with a series of newsreel headlines in the fateful year of 1978, and then goes on to combine the intimate stories of several Americans, Dean Price, the son of tobacco farmers in the rural South who becomes an evangelist for a new economy in the rural South, Tammy Thomas, a factory worker in Youngstown trying to survive the collapse of her city, Jeff Conaton, a Washington insider bouncing between political idealism and the lure of organized money, and Peter Thiel, a Silicon Valley billionaire with a radical vision of the future. And he combines these with biographical sketches of this era's leading public figures, from Newt Gingrich to Oprah to Jay-Z, and collages made from newspaper headlines, advertising slogans, song lyrics. He captures the flow of events and undercurrents that have set America in decline. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, and media. It's all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. George Packer, a staff writer for The New Yorker, was awarded two Overseas Press Club Awards in 2003, one for his examination of the difficulties faced during the occupation and reconstruction of Iraq, and the other for his coverage of the Civil War in Sierra Leone. His book, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, was named one of the 10 best books of 2005 by the New York Times. Packer, who served in the Peace Corps in Togo, West Africa, is also the author of The Village of Waiting, Blood of the Liberals, Interesting Times, Writings from a Turbulent Decade, a couple of novels, a play, and most recently, the one we're going to talk about, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. Welcome, George Packer, to Free Forum.
It is great to be with you, Terrence.
Thank you. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So I just did a quick bio. But could you tell us in your own words, and remember, we've got an hour today, so tell us a bit about your path, the way it looks to you, to the work you do today, feeling free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
I had a long, circuitous and often thwarted road to journalism, to The New Yorker, and to The Unwinding. I was a Peace Corps volunteer, as you mentioned. I came back from Africa sort of disillusioned with myself and with the sort of foreordained paths I'd been on, a bit of reverse culture shock, a bit of depression, and I ended up being a carpenter for 4 years in Boston, made my living doing renovations while writing a book about the years I was in West Africa with the Peace Corps called The Village of Waiting. And then just when I found my calling as a nonfiction writer, I decided to write two novels, which were probably read by 50 or 100 people. So that was 10 years of learning to write but not being recognized as a writer. And finally, it was moving to New York at age 40 in 2000 and publishing a book called Blood of the Liberals, which is a century-long portrait of liberalism through three generations of my family, that I began to get some opportunities as a journalist and finally was hired by The New Yorker in 2003, just at the start of the Iraq War. I had been doing reporting for them from West Africa, the horrible civil wars of Ivory Coast and Sierra Leone, and then I was sent to Iraq in the wake of the invasion and overthrow of the regime of Saddam Hussein, and spent really the next 5 years completely immersed in that story, writing many magazine pieces and a book. And it was really Iraq that made me begin to think about the unwinding. It was such a picture of American inability and incompetence, and not just among leaders, but among whole institutions, from Congress and the military to the media, the intelligence agencies, that I began to think this is a bigger story about the country. And when I came back from Iraq, it was just in time for the election of Obama and the financial crisis. All sorts of institutions were collapsing, Wall Street banks, General Motors. Seemed like a big epical story that needed some form, and I began to do a bunch of reporting around the country. Tampa, the housing bust in Tampa, the hard economic times in rural Virginia and North Carolina and other places, and Washington too, and the bollocksed up Senate, and that all gave me the idea of a big panoramic, generation-long history of the country, but told very intimately through the lives of a handful of Americans who have been living to the pulse of this history as the social contract has come undone and our institutions have eroded or collapsed. So that's a short career history and an account of how I came to write this book.
Very good. Let me double back on a couple of things there. I found an interesting quote. I think it was in an interview you did in which you said, and this is just to touch on a piece of your life story, "I grew up in Silicon Valley before it was ever called Silicon Valley, but I left before the future arrived." Just if you will, a bit about that, a bit about the Silicon Valley you grew up in and kind of how you left before the future arrived.
Right. I was born in 1960, so I'm of the cohort that is the generation of the unwinding in my book. My parents were faculty members at Stanford. I grew up in this really idyllic place, Stanford in Palo Alto, during what I kind of think of, maybe everyone is prone to romanticizing their childhood, but other than a few campus disturbances and you know, an earthquake or two, it was kind of a wonderful place to be a kid because it was a middle class and rather egalitarian community. Everyone went to public school. There were certainly rich and poor, but the extremes were not that great. The divisions between classes and ethnicities were softer in the Palo Alto and Santa Clara area than probably just about anywhere in the country. And it was sort of the golden age of public schools and public institutions, and California as a state where those institutions were at their very best. The UC system, the high school I went to in Palo Alto was a great school. And the year I graduated, which is 78, which you called a fateful year, I think that's an accurate description, was the year Proposition 13 passed in California, beginning the decline of our public schools. So I sort of got out just ahead of that. and left to go to college and never came back to live in the Bay Area. While I was gone, California's public institutions eroded, and meanwhile, my hometown became this new mecca of technology, Silicon Valley, which no one called it when I was a kid. It became a fabulously wealthy place. The Stanford Shopping Center was kind of ground zero of wealth and consumption in the area, and a more unequal place than it ever was when I was growing up there. Private schools became more and more sort of the path that wealthier families took for their kids. Public schools were privatized, you know, with local foundations making up for the loss of public money, and it just became more like the way the rest of the country became. And so I think of 1978 as one of those dividing lines between a before and after. And to me, the before was a pretty great American moment in a pretty great American place.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because I didn't know what that little window would lead us to, but I see that it really does. The golden age of pre-Silicon Valley, and then it becomes the site of some of the most incredible. Inequality and access, as well as good fortune and prosperity and optimism and all of those things. So let me tell people, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with George Packer. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and is the author most recently of The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. And to learn more of George's work, you can go to The New Yorker website. And for The Unwinding, you can go to the publisher's site, us.macmillan.com. You're better known for your work on foreign affairs, and I found it interesting that you said it was around Iraq and looking at how we had gotten into that, that you began to see that this was more than a foreign policy issue. But you've written about atrocities in Sierra Leone, civil unrest in the Ivory Coast, the megacity of Lagos, global counterinsurgency. It's quite a departure from what we know of you. I mean, obviously, we didn't know about your novels.
So
it may not be as much it may not be as much of a departure for you as for others. But how was working on this book different? How was it the same?
Well, it's not a complete departure. I've always been obsessed with American history and America. I mean, it's been the thing at the center of my professional work and my thinking. My parents, you know, were very political people. My grandfather on my mother's side was a congressman from Birmingham, Alabama, a kind of populist at the beginning of the 20th century, back when the South produced rather radical figures in Congress. So I have America and tradition and politics in my blood, and that's why I wrote Blood of the Liberals. And this is a bit of a return to that, but it's very different in this way. Blood of the Liberals was a memoir, a three-generational memoir, and all of my nonfiction work has used the word I in one way or another to guide the reader through whether it's the implosion of Iraq after the American invasion or my experience as a Peace Corps volunteer or the history of liberalism in the 20th century. In this book, in The Unwinding, there is no I. It is all third person, and it's all through the eyes and experiences and language, the sentence structure, the jokes, the metaphors of my characters. I got out of the way. I thought to create a novelistic portrait of the country, as soon as I appears, it sort of gets distracting. And, well, who are you? Why are you commenting on this? I'm enjoying this movie. Quit talking. That became the structural and literary imperative of the book, to keep it in the point of view of the characters, whether the obscure ones who are at the heart of the book or the celebrities whose profiles appear throughout the book. I used their writings, their autobiographies, their songs, to tell their stories, sometimes to an ironic effect because they don't always come off the way they think they do. So it's a complete departure for me in being more like a novel than any work of nonfiction I've written.
Okay, and let me just – I did it in the intro. I'm going to do it a little more now, paint the picture of how this book is structured. As you mentioned, there's a few characters, unknown folks, unknown Americans, who reappear chapter, and then, you know, a few other chapters will intervene, and then another chapter along their story. A few more chapters go elsewhere, and then along their story. So there's these few people that we follow throughout the book, and then these brief chapters on celebrities, icons, and so on. Oprah Winfrey, Colin Powell, Alice Waters, etc. They get each one brief chapter in the course of the book. So it tells the unfolding story of regular Americans, populated by occasional stories of the rich and famous.
And it moves through history from 78 to the present. So there's a chronological trajectory that organizes the whole story.
Exactly. And as I mentioned in the intro again, that right after the prologue and before the first chapter is a collage of headlines, ad copy, song lyrics, that sort of thing. That happens each time you jump, and it isn't every year. It's I think it goes 78 to 84 to 87, that sort of thing, and you're taking this swipe at chapters in these 35 years from 78 to the present. You also structure it in three parts. What to you is the dividing line between those three parts?
I think that the best way to see the overall architecture is the first part is everything leading to the financial crisis, which is kind of the watershed event for everyone in the book. And I hope we'll talk about the individual characters, but each of them comes to a kind of reckoning, if not an absolute catastrophe, around 2008. As do many of the celebrities. Robert Rubin's story culminates with the Wall Street collapse of 2008. And Elizabeth Warren's story, you know, she becomes a public figure at that point. So the financial crisis, to me, is the moment at which you can sort of see, almost as if through an X-ray, the debilitated state of all these institutions, as well as the event that propels so many Americans into new troubles and also new ways of life. It exposes the, for example, the hollow foundation underneath Tampa, this Sunbelt explosive growth machine that all comes to a halt with the housing collapse. So that's the first part. The second part is the financial crisis itself and its, you know, effect on the characters in the book. And the third part is the falling out from 2009 to the present. So really, the book telescopes a lot of history into its first part from 78 to 2008, and then it begins to get much denser and close as it moves closer to the present.
Right, and as you say, that part two is as how they experience the crisis, and part three, the shortest part, is what seems to be coming after.
I think of the crisis as being something that took a long time to create, and that's why you need to go back to the late 70s to begin the story in order to understand what it meant and why it happened in the lives of these people once the crisis occurred.
It is interesting. I'm certain you chose 78, you know, on your own based on, as you said, it's when you graduated. It's when certain, but I must say I received a book in the mail last week called Strange Rebels, and it's 78, 79. I read in one of the other books I was prepping for the show within the last 2 or 3 weeks. It says people may not realize it, but the turning point was 78. It's interesting, a year that I think at the time went sort of unnoticed. It's one of the last years.
70s. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Reagan comes in 80, and that we refer to, but 78 sort of – let's say what you were going to say.
Yeah, well, the 70s was this formless decade when nothing definite seemed to be happening, you know, and it's hard to get your hands on it. But actually, a book called Winner Take All Politics,
yes,
by Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson sort of put 78 on my radar. They talk about several bills in Congress that died – or were filibustered to death, or were defeated a consumer protection bureau, very like the one that Elizabeth Warren dreamed up, went down to defeat. A reform of the capital gains tax went down to defeat, and labor law went down to defeat. And it was kind of a sign that even with a Democrat in the White House and Democrats controlling both houses of Congress, something new was going on in Washington and the country. And that new thing was business organizing itself with powerful lobbying arms like the Business Roundtable and spending a lot of money for the first time to defeat legislation business didn't like. And this was really a relatively new thing. And it led to, for example, Douglas Frazier of the UAW withdrawing from Jimmy Carter's Business Labor Council, saying, and this is a line that's quoted in the collage of the year 78 in my book, he says, the leaders of industry, commerce, and finance in the United States have broken and discarded the fragile, unwritten compact previously existing during a past period of growth and progress. That's from Frazier's letter to Jimmy Carter explaining his withdrawal from the council, and that's a turning point.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I and let me just say, people who listen to the show on a regular basis know my enormously high regard for winner-take-all politics by Hacker and Pearson. And,
yeah, I thought it was terrific. And the other thing in 78 is the rise of computer technology. Mm-hmm. It's when the Apple II is the first really popular personal computer. It's the beginning of Silicon Valley. So, and the beginning of deindustrialization. The steel mills of Youngstown start closing very rapidly right around 1978. So both of those things, the end of the industrial age, the beginning of the information age, happened right around that time.
That's the voice of George Packer, staff writer at The New Yorker, author of the book we're talking about right now, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. And if this book is new to you today, look for it. This is one of those books that's gonna, you know, that's going to be, you know, read and referred to for quite a while. We're definitely going to get into each of the individual stories. Obviously, at the top, I said I want the stories, but I'm going to ask you a little bit more about this process because it is an interesting process. You obviously use some of your past experience with novels, plays, and so on, you know, to get at character interaction and dialogue and so on. How did you find your characters? And if one thing I've read in other things I've read about when you've talked about writing this book is that it did not always have the form it has today, that these lead characters were not in. You write about having a sense of panic when you finished your research and you're still not sure how it fits together. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, this came together in a very unusual and terrifying way, which is to say I had done all this reporting, 2 or 3 years worth, without knowing what the story was and what the structure was. I'd never done that before. Basically, you know, I set about with this big ambition to write a book showing how America had changed over the course of this past generation. At times, I thought it would be a kind of straightforward history where I'd have to devote a chapter to the Clinton impeachment, even though I didn't want to have to do that, but how else could I write it? At other times, I thought maybe this is a picture of each institution using sort of a leader who failed, like Colin Powell or Robert Rubin, who ended up in this book, but they would have been much more important figures in a more institution and elite focused book. But my wife reminded me at the point where I was panicking and wondering how am I going to get all this material into a book, that I had already come up with the answer and then discarded it at the start of the process, and that was to use the model of the USA trilogy by John Dos Passos, the great three-novel trilogy about the first three decades of the 20th century, as a guide, combining the stories of obscure, unknown people, in his case fictional, in my case not, with portraits of the leaders of the era and collages that get at kind of the collective mind along the way at given moments. And to make it kind of jazzier and more unusual, more experimental. I'm not an experimental writer. I'm a real steak and potatoes kind of nonfiction writer. I'm not a formal, you know, experimenter. I'm not a grand stylist. My style is the plain style. It always has been. But I felt the need to liberate myself a bit, to try something new. And because of the nature of the material, I had all these characters and all this history without a form. I needed an experimental form in, just in order to get it into one story. But the key to making it work was to have a through line, which was this generational long saga, and to count on the reader to connect the dots, to figure out why Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, is next to Dean Price, mm-hmm. who one of the unknown characters who reminds me a little of Sam Walton.
Why
Tammy Thomas, another unknown, is next to Oprah Winfrey.
Right. But another thing you do, by the way, when you said you don't, you depend on readers to make the connections, I have certainly seen books where people will start what appear to be disparate stories and then bring them together. And you'll see that so-and-so, you know, Forrest Gump-like shows up in the story of that. That doesn't happen here. These individual stories are individual stories. It's, as you say, it's the reader's job to see how there's a web there.
Well, I was stuck with the facts. I couldn't make Dean Price and Tammy Thomas suddenly meet each other on the street in Youngstown. They only met after the book was done when they both came and stayed at my house. So I had to... These are separate stories, but there are a lot of resonances between them, and it's for the reader to find the resonances. What I didn't want to do was write one more book about the erosion of the middle class or income inequality or, you know, the rise of the new right. All of those are incredibly important themes, and good books have already been written about them. I had no heart to write a policy book. I wanted to write a big narrative. I thought that's what I can do that hasn't been done about this subject and that might give readers a fresh way of thinking about it.
So as I asked you, George Packer, we're talking about The Unwinding, how did you choose the few key Americans who become your stories? How did these characters show up?
Well, it began by happenstance. Dean Price was the first one I met, and it was through reporting another New Yorker story about a congressional district in Southern Virginia during Obama's first year. And Dean was a local guy from rural North Carolina who happened to own a truck stop just over the state line in Martinsville, Virginia. And it was an interesting truck stop because it was the country's only fully biodiesel truck stop. He and his partner had a closed loop of going from the farm to the pump using canola seeds to make canola oil to make biodiesel. That was interesting to me. Even more interesting was Dean himself, who, from the moment I heard him on the phone, was this wonderful speaker, explainer, salesman, visionary, quirky and kind of self-made, his own guy, and I wanted to get to know him better. I was drawn to the something indigenous and American about his voice and about his experience. So I started going down to North Carolina, where he lives, in a little tiny town on US 220, and maybe over 6 or 8 visits, living in his house, meeting his family, driving around with him in his beat-up car and just hearing him talk and tell me his dreams and tell me his quest to revive the countryside from Walmart and multinational oil by using what's at hand, canola waste restaurant oil, to create a new fuel type. This was just irresistible to me. And his story was the first one that I gathered and sort of gave a shape to.
Let me just cut in for a second, because I've read where you say you were speaking to him on the phone, and just a few minutes into the conversation, you said, "I'm coming down. I don't want to lose this without doing it in person." So I can imagine that moment as a writer when you go, "This is coming to life."
He was saying to me how he came to biodiesel. He said, "With Hurricane Katrina, the flow of imported diesel was cut off, and it nearly drove him out of business, and he had a, quote, come-to-Jesus moment." where he realized we're so dependent on foreign oil and on our own multinational oil companies that the little guy cannot compete. And that set him thinking about biodiesel. And he was about 30 seconds into that with this tremendously exciting, sense of epiphany.
Yeah.
And a southern accent, a country accent. And I just said, stop. I was afraid that if he told the whole thing to me on the phone, the next time it wouldn't be as fresh.
Yeah.
I was wrong about that. I've actually heard him tell this story many times now, and it always sounds exciting and fresh. But I didn't want to ruin it, so I said, let me come down and meet you. And he was very gracious and wanted to be written about. I think he thought it might be good for his own project. Plus, we hit it off. I mean, the precondition for any of this is for people to be willing to let me hang out with them and ask a lot of very impertinent and intrusive questions over days, weeks, and months. That's a high barrier to clear. And Dean was the first one who I cleared it with, and his story kind of became the backbone of the book.
Mm-hmm. Let me just tell people we're at the halfway point. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with George Packer. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author most recently of The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. To learn more, you can go to, for George's work, you can go to The New Yorker website, and for The Unwinding, you can go to the publisher's website, us.macmillan.com. So let's stay with Dean Price then for a second so people can get the feel for this. So we've got the sense of who he is. So his story over these 35 years.
He's a son of the Bible Belt, rural white North Carolina, the tobacco and textile part of the state, which is not the forward-looking, prosperous, progressive research triangle. It's the other part in the western part of North Carolina. His father was a fire and brimstone preacher who failed as a preacher, failed as a father, ended up committing suicide, was a kind of a harsh figure around the house, and Dean rebelled against his father and against sort of the code of that little town and wanted to become an entrepreneur, but wanted to do it in his home area. He wasn't looking to get away. He has a real attachment to the land, to the old family tobacco farm, which, like all the tobacco farms around there, is no longer productive or very productive. He tried to found this chain of truck stops along U.S. 220 between Greensboro, North Carolina, and Martinsville, Virginia, with fast food restaurants attached. And found increasingly that he couldn't compete because Walmart was moving in and Sheets Oil was moving in, discount gas chain. And he began to turn away from kind of the Republicanism of his upbringing and to become more radicalized. I see Dean as kind of like a populist figure from the 1890s, suspicious of all forms of concentrated power. And as I mentioned earlier, Hurricane Katrina suddenly brought him to this reckoning that his old way of doing business and the old way of life in his region was not viable anymore. It was becoming a poor region. These very proud, self-reliant people were now on public assistance. There was a big drug problem. Meth and crack were in the area. Obesity was rampant. It was becoming just a culture of poverty like the inner city, and it was and the job base was gone. Textile factories were closing, furniture factories were closing, so there needed to be some transformative vision, and Dean had it. It was biodiesel. Now, I don't know if biodiesel is the answer for the Piedmont, the Carolina Piedmont. Mm. It's the answer for Dean. I was more interested in Dean than in his theories of peak oil and biodiesel and the green economy and local production of fuel and food. I'm interested in all that, but Dean himself is the reason I kept going back there to see how he pursued this vision. He kept getting knocked down. Bankruptcy, business bankruptcy, his partnership broke up. He got into a lot of trouble. He even had some legal problems, and came close to giving it all up and even to ending his life at one point. And he never did, which is, I think, part of why I was so drawn to him. There was this resilience, this optimistic faith in America that I think is part of maybe of the countryside and of that very old traditional region, a real belief that if he wanted it enough and was bold enough and worked hard enough, it would all come to him.
Yeah, and he's buttressed in that belief, as you point out, by coming upon certain writers, and Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill is a very important book to him. And what's interesting is, and I'm guessing this is part of what attracted you to him, is a lot of people read that book at some point. A lot of people start doing affirmations, you know, and make visions of their future and so on. But his resilience in the face of being knocked down so many times is remarkable.
Yeah, it's really faith. I mean, he is a Christian, but he's an unorthodox Christian, nothing like the fundamentalist Christianity of his father. He turned against that. He is he's an optimistic, you know, believer in that Native American creed of the power of your own mind. It sort of goes back to Emerson and forward through this guy Napoleon Hill, who Andrew Carnegie assigned to write an account of how one became successful. It's really the first How to Succeed in Business book in American history. It came out in the 20s. When Dean stumbled across Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, it was like finding the Bible. Mm-hmm. I mean, he can quote whole passages of it for every occasion, and it is a commitment to a faith in oneself.
If you can see it.
It's a fragile thing, because the self is a fragile thing.
Exactly.
But Dean has clung to it through thick and thin in a way that that bears witness.
Yeah, and what I agree. I like your tying it back, going to from whom Napoleon Hill proceeds, which, as you say, is as American as the Transcendentalists, as American as Emerson and Thoreau and Fuller and all of that, that strain of America that still lives. I'm speaking with George Packer. We're talking about right now about some of the lead characters in his new book, which traces America's unwinding, the book called The Unwinding, America's Unwinding, from the late 70s to the present. Let's talk about Tammy Thomas.
Yeah, you know, I just want to say one more thing about that American faith. Oprah Winfrey is a great contemporary evangelist for the faith in mind. You know, she just gave the commencement speech at Harvard, and that was her whole point, was, you know, if you want it enough, if you believe in yourself, you will get it. So it's all over my book, because Oprah is one of the celebrities profiled in the book. So many of the characters seem to turn in some way to this, I think, kind of magical thinking.
Yeah, if I can imagine it, if I can envision it, if I can think positively enough about it for long enough, it will happen.
I think it's a creed that comes to the fore during difficult times,
you know,
during times of economic trouble. So Tammy Thomas is a little younger than Dean Price. She was born in the mid-60s. And she, too, was born into a community that worked. It was Youngstown, which was a steel city. It was only steel. And as long as steel was there, Youngstown had a job base that provided, you know, a good blue-collar life for most people. But Tammy was born into a very troubled family. Her mother had a heroin addiction from the beginning of Tammy's life. And when Tammy was – by the time she was 3 or 4, she was taking care of her mother. She described to me how she would – her mother would smoke in bed, and Tammy would try to keep herself awake so that after her mother fell asleep, she could put out her mother's cigarette as a very young girl. Mm. And that's the kind of poignant detail that you only hear after you've spent a lot of time just hanging out with someone, as I did with Tammy. She seemed headed for the fate of so many young black women in the inner city. She had her first child when she was 16, and two more soon after that. There was no father who was going to be with her to take care of any of them. Meanwhile, Youngstown lost its whole economic foundation in about 4 years. Every major steel mill closed, and very quickly, the city turned into an arson epidemic, a crime epidemic, white flight, all the problems of the Rust Belt that we know so well. Deindustrialization happened in Youngstown quickest and earliest, and so it's a real icon of that.
Let me mention one detail that you mentioned, George, which sets the scope of it for someone who doesn't know the old Rust Belt. You say that for 25 miles along, I believe it's along a river,
the Mahoning River, yeah.
One steel mill after another for 25 miles.
Yeah, I mean, if you go from the northwest in Warren, Ohio, northwest of Youngstown, through the heart of the city, and some of the mills like U.S. Steel were right in downtown Youngstown along the river. And, of course, it was filthy, it was hot, it was ugly. The jobs were brutal. They crushed the body. They depleted the spirit, but they provided an economic base to life. All the way down into Campbell and Struthers, which is where Tammy's family lived, it was just one mill after another. And as one citizen of Youngstown said to me, you could turn down any street and see the glowing fires of the blast furnaces. And then they all went dead.
Right.
In absolutely, you know, breathtaking speed. And it was as if a plague had just swept away 50,000 jobs in this rather small metropolitan area, of a catastrophic occurrence which somehow never got sort of the concentrated attention of the country, like, we have to do something about this. Instead, it was sort of allowed to happen like a natural illness or something.
Mm-hmm.
Tammy had to raise her three kids in this collapsing city, and she did it because she got, partly through her own sheer toughness and resilience and commitment to her children and her community, but she also had she got a good job, one of the last good jobs in Youngstown at an auto parts factory. She worked on the assembly line for 20 years, got close to her pension, which is the goal, and then Delphi, the company, did what companies have been doing now for some time, declared bankruptcy in order to get out of its contracts and send almost all those jobs to Mexico. So Tammy had to take a buyout, lost most of her pension, and in her mid-40s found herself without work.
And when you say get out of its contracts for pensions and benefits were the primary contracts it was getting out of, right?
Yeah, these were union jobs.
Yeah.
And they were some of the last union jobs, you know, in the private sector in America. So one of the stories that this tells is the story of the declining power of unions and how companies began to feel more and more free to tear up both the written contracts but also the unwritten contract that said, we need each other. We can't push it too hard or else things are going to start to collapse. That's what has happened across the Rust Belt and in other industries. So Tammy is suddenly alone, like so many of the characters in the book. She's on her own in this devastated city without a means of support. And this is sort of the turn that she, Dean Price, and the others take. She reinvents herself, in her case, becoming a community organizer, just in time for the 2008 election of another black community organizer. And she is now part of a group that is trying to bring Youngstown back from the dead, to get vacant housing torn down, to bring urban gardens to the city. And it's, again, a kind of desperate and yet inspiring story.
Yeah. That's George Packer. We're talking about the lives and the ideas in his book, The Unwinding. If you could talk just briefly about Jeff Connaughton, and then I want to look more at sort of the big picture and conclusions and that sort of thing.
So Jeff Connaughton is the third major character in the book. Again, the same generation as Dean and Tammy. He's from Alabama, from a middle-class family. When he's 19 years old or 20 years old, he hears Joe Biden give a speech at the University of Alabama, and he's electrified. He sees in Biden another Kennedy, and he attaches his ambitions to Biden. And even though he goes off to Wall Street and spends a few years as an investment banker, he never forgets Biden. And when Biden runs for president in the 88 campaign, Jeff Connaughton quits his banking job and goes to work for Biden, only to be disillusioned because the campaign ended in ignominy with plagiarism accusations. But Jeff sticks with Biden, partly out of just a pragmatic sense that if he's going to make it in Washington and get to the top of the heap in Washington, maybe as a White House aide, he needs to have a kind of patron. As he says, everyone in Washington is somebody's guy.
Right. As you say,
Biden guy.
It's no good to be an ex-Biden guy. Even if you're not happy being a Biden guy, it's better than being an ex-Biden guy.
Yeah, what good is that? Who wants, you know, to hang out and network with an ex-Biden guy? It's a very transactional picture of Washington.
Yeah.
These relationships are based on what you can do for me and what I can do for you. In Jeff Connaughton's case, it's kind of one way because Biden just doesn't seem to take note of him or to feel much gratitude for all of Connaughton's efforts to raise money and do other things for Biden. And eventually, Connaughton gets disillusioned enough that after a stint in the Clinton White House, he does what so many Washington insiders do. He becomes a lobbyist. And his story is partly the story of how money has taken over Washington in this generation of the unwinding and come to matter more even than the deep divisions between the two parties. So Connaughton makes a fortune as a lobbyist with one of the leading firms in the city. And then the financial crisis is his reckoning too. He gets over-leveraged on real estate in Costa Rica. He loses a lot of his wealth in the stock market. Just in time for the election of Obama-Biden, Biden's seat in Delaware is taken by Ted Kaufman, who is very close to Jeff Connaughton. Kaufman brings Connaughton back into government as his chief of staff for 2 years in the Senate. And together, they make as their mission, because neither of them is going to be there for long, and they're kind of free of the need to raise money, and that liberates them to take on Wall Street. And Connaughton's whole purpose is break up the big banks, restore Glass-Steagall, bring Wall Street to heel. He's kind of come to realize that partly through the work he was doing as a lobbyist, Washington is now controlled by big money. And he is sort of shocked at how much that has become the case once he gets back in and realizes no ordinary people ever come to lobby the senators. It's all being done by business lobbies and big interests.
Yeah, what's interesting is that point that you point out is that someone who longed to go to Washington out of some idealism, that stint that he has with Kaufman, because Kaufman does not plan to run for re-election, is about as close as anyone gets to idealism in Washington today.
Yeah, and it's, you know, in Connaughton's case, it's both idealism, but he also wants to taste power.
Yes.
And that is what draws a lot of people to Washington. And the two goals can become mixed, and you can kind of lose sight of one through the other. He ends with a burst of idealism because he's made his money, he's lost some of it, and he suddenly sees clearly that what he needs to do is begin the process of ridding Washington of this corruption that has set in and paralyzed government over this generation. And that's his really best years are working with Kaufman.
Absolutely. Kaufman, as I, you know, noted during his time in the Senate, was because of his freedom that he actually was a public servant with an enormous amount of experience, was very strong. We could do another whole show on the unraveling of Dodd-Frank.
which is a big part of Connaughton's story.
As the story. One thing I wanted to say, and I'm going to shift now a little bit first into something about the form, which is that when I'm not on the radio, I actually work with organizations on story and narrative, and I've asked myself, is there a difference? Because I use them fairly interchangeably, so do most people. And what I've said doesn't hold true all the time is that a story usually has a protagonist, a beginning, middle, and end. A narrative doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end. A narrative has a past, present, and future, and is unfolding. And what I see here is you've got these individual stories that also don't have ends. They only end because the clock sort of ticks out and you've got to finish the book. But they're all strands in a much bigger narrative. That is, you know, the individual stories populate the narrative. The narrative makes sense of the individual stories. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great description of what's going on in the book. Each of these stories has to be interesting or riveting in itself. And a big decision for me as a writer was how to break them up and sequence them so that I gave the reader enough of Dean Price that we could then leave Dean Price for a few chapters.
And be satisfied, and
And meet Tammy Thomas and Jeff Connaughton and Newt Gingrich and Oprah Winfrey, and then come back to Dean Price without the reader losing track of him. So that was – and each individual chapter had to have its own drama and tension so that you wanted to know what's going to come next, so that you're willing to wait to return to Dean. And their lives cooperated with that.
Yes.
There's all these twists and turns and unexpected revelations and setbacks, and life is interesting. It keeps changing and surprising you. And these characters' lives are tremendously surprising. And but it's all part of, as you say, a much bigger narrative, which doesn't have a definite end. They're all continuing to live. Life continues to change. There's a kind of ambiguity, I think, to the ending, because there's both a dark picture of America in our time and also these embers of hope in the ways in which all these characters have remade themselves and are looking carefully at their lives and their communities.
Yeah, there isn't one of them who ends up committing suicide. There isn't one of them. They all are somehow in the process of reinvention as the book ends.
And they're kind of left to do it by themselves. You know, Obama is a sort of peripheral figure. He's there in the peripheral vision of all the characters. But he begins as a figure of hope and I think gradually disappoints maybe Dean and Jeff more than Tammy. But all of them, having looked to either a company or Washington or a congressman or a philosopher, all of those have sort of sequentially failed them. They are left with themselves, with their own abilities, which is both, you know, a very American thing and a very good thing, but also a very fragile thing, because we're not alone. We need society. We need institutions to support us, and they don't have them.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the desperation, the hopeful desperation in which all of them find themselves at the end of the book.
And let me read you a couple of quotes. You write that there have been previous unwindings in U.S. history, George Packer. You say each decline brought renewal, each implosion re-released energy. Out of each unwinding came a new cohesion. What will the mechanisms of self-correction be? I thought 2008 was it, the total collapse of our financial system, the election of our first black president. Those two things happening simultaneously were going to be a big historical turn along the lines of Roosevelt and Reagan getting elected. But I think you'd be hard-pressed to make that case today for a lot of reasons. Is there a renewal coming out of this last unwinding?
I can't say that I see it. I'm not prescient. I don't pretend to know the future. I don't particularly care for books that tell you what the future is going to be like, because I trust more the evidence of my eyes and ears. But I suppose what I can say is there are more and more Americans who are coming to some reckoning with the place where we're at now, which is to say we're stuck politically. We are in chronic stagnation economically, and we're in a kind of cultural state of permanent distractedness with technological gadgets and the lives of celebrities, and something has to give in order to do the hard work of reform, whether it comes out of ending the filibuster in Washington or trying again at regulating Wall Street, or maybe more likely in very out-of-the-way places where the media isn't paying attention, ordinary people starting with their own street and their own community, which is a painful, slow, hard way to do it. But unlike the New Deal, I don't think it's going to happen from on high any longer. I don't think those institutions are working well enough to lead the way. I think it will be much more piecemeal and much more local. And maybe part of it is simply Americans coming to an understanding of the country as being a former empire that is now has the task of managing its own decline in a way that is as fair and decent for as many people as possible, which isn't a banner you want to
right.
necessarily wave, but it may be the sober reality.
Yeah, make the best of our unwinding. I'm going to read, actually, to finish this interview, George Packer, I'm going to read some of the lines that come I can't remember whether I chose them because they're at the end of the book or at the end of the prologue. But in the unwinding, everything changes and nothing lasts except for the voices. American voices, open, sentimental, angry, matter-of-fact, inflected with borrowed ideas, God, TV, and the dimly remembered past, telling a joke above the noise of the assembly line, complaining behind window shades drawn against the world, thundering justice to a crowded park or an empty chamber, closing a deal on the phone, dreaming aloud late at night on a front porch as trucks rush by in the darkness. George Packer, thank you for this book and for the work you've done all along, but this one is really, I think, a timely contribution. The book is The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. To learn more about George's work, you can go to the New Yorker website. For The Unwinding, you can go to the publisher's website, us.macmillan.com. Thank you, George Packer. Keep up the good work.
I completely enjoyed it. Thank you.
Okay. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes or at my site. For podcast articles and transcripts and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, including looking at my work with story and narrative in organizations, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues and usually three or four articles of background, you can sign up at my site or by emailing me at T.E. McNally, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y. at mac.com. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi and Mark Maxwell in production. And to you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. Check out my show at davidpakman.com. That's David, P-A-K-M-A-N.com.
Here's something funny. Kentucky State Senator Brandon Smith's lawyer argued in court that he should not be charged with driving under the influence because of a provision in the state constitution. I think you're really going to like this. Brandon Smith is a Republican, just so you know. Smith was arrested towards the beginning of the year, charged with speeding and a DUI after allegedly blowing a .088 on a preliminary breath test. He was reportedly driving 65 miles an hour in a 45 mile an hour zone. His attorney, Bill Johnson, filed a motion saying the charges should be dropped altogether because Section 43 of the state constitution says that Smith should never have been arrested in the first place. And the quote from that section is, "The members of the General Assembly shall, in all cases except treason, felony, breach, or surety of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance on the sessions of their respective houses, and in going to and returning from the same, and for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place." And Bill Johnson told the Associated Press that the provision was added to state law back in 1891 to keep legislators from being bothered by people who would arrest them during sessions. I have a very basic question about this, Lewis. How does drunk driving not violate the surety of the peace to everyone else who's on the road at the time?
I think that is a great question, and I think that pretty much sums this up. And also, let me give the viewers some extra insight into this senator.
Yeah.
This was the same guy who a while back, and we covered the story, said that climate change is a hoax because Earth and Mars have the exact same temperature. And that's who we're talking about here.
A lot of these odd laws, not surprisingly, were actually passed in the post-Civil War era. And they were really aimed at maintaining privilege, at protecting privilege, in spite of the fact that we no longer were allowed to own slaves in the U.S. And I don't know specifically whether this is one of those laws, but I've read about many of them. And the fact that they're now being cited is funny, but it's also funny to me that even the law as written shouldn't really be protecting this guy.
No, not at all. This is a clear violation, and I really hope that he does not get away with this.
You've been listening to part of the David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and much more, check out our website, davidpakman.com. That's David, P-A-K-M-A-N.com. And check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedavidpakmanshow.